Hello, I'm Jill Burridge, and today I'm talking to Sally Buck, who actually lived in St Albans for a number of years. You started to raise your family here, and you were in a practice nurse, weren't you?
Yes, I worked at Midway Surgery, and we lived here up until 1990.
And then you moved to Exeter.
Yes, my husband's office relocated down there, so it was an appropriate time for the children. They were sort of just going to secondary school and just starting GCSE, so it worked quite well.
But what we're going to talk about more today is what you've been doing of late, because your husband, Graham, sadly died. After that, you retired, and actually you've carved out a second or third career working for charities such as Shelterbox. Tell me what Shelterbox actually does.
Shelterbox is a disaster relief organisation, and we respond to disasters all over the world. I'm a volunteer with them, and I'm what's called a response team member. So I'm on call at certain times when it fits into my life. And so I say when I'm going to be available. If a disaster occurs, then I will be asked. I say me, but there's about 250 of people like me who are volunteers all over the world. So we can get a team together quite quickly to go out and assess the situation and then distribute aid.
Yes, and Shelterbox, I mean, it does what it says on the tin, really. Mm-hmm. There are boxes, aren't there? What do the boxes contain?
Well, the box contains a large family-sized tent, which is for a minimum of five people. If the people are small, like children, then you can get a bigger family in them. But, you know, it should really be for a family of about five. It's got water purification in it. It's got ground sheets, blankets, mosquito nets, a kitchen set. The sort of stuff you need immediately post-disaster that will give you some dignity and the ability to have some privacy and start your life again, really.
Shelterbox is a West Country charity. It started in Cornwall, I think?
Yes, right down in Helston. And it was started by a man who had a vision. Something happened in the world and he thought, what would I need if my family lost everything, you know, such as their home and all their possessions? And he was a Rotarian, or he is a Rotarian, not was. And he put together a big green box and filled it with the sort of things. And his Rotary Club took it on as a project. And it's now part of the International Rotary Project. And we get a certain amount of our income through Rotary, which is very, very positive.
But you work alongside, presumably, all the other aid agencies post-disaster.
Oh, absolutely. We work in what's called a cluster system. So we're always in the shelter cluster. And so we're working very closely with UNHCR and other UN agencies and organisations like Plan International and ACTED, which is a French charity. So we work closely with them so that we're not duplicating work, really, which would be crazy.
So how does the system work? The logistics must be quite hair-raising because, I mean, these boxes are not small.
No. And we have to ship them in from all over the world. So what we try and do is in a cold way, we distribute aid to certain distribution centres around the world. So we've got places in Central America, we've got them in the Middle East, and they'll be stored there. So when there's a disaster somewhere, they can be flown. So if you send them by ship, it's much cheaper. And then the last leg of the journey would be by air. And so we try and keep costs down as much as possible because we're completely supported by the public. We don't get government money unless there's a huge disaster, but we are all, you know, public donation.
And you've been, I think, to Jordan twice, which is working on the borders with the Syrian refugees.
Yes. Well, I've been out there three times now to Jordan, and that's been a negotiation situation about whether our aid is appropriate for their country. They have taken in a huge amount of refugees. And so we've been there to try and support them. But I also went out to northern Iraq, to Kurdistan, right on the Syrian border. There we've distributed a lot of aid. And, you know, the people are living in abject conditions there. We've also got a new bit to our tent, which is a winterization kit, which is a bit like tin foil that we put on the inside of the tent that can increase the heat. Because, you know, there's the wind is unbelievable up there. You know, it comes off the mountains, across the plain, and at this time of year it's, you know, full of snow. And these people are just living in awful conditions.
We've seen the sort of pictures on the news of the bitter weather that has hit that area.
And this is their second winter living like that.
And what is it like when you actually arrive in that sort of situation in northern Iraq? Can you just describe, I mean, when, how do you get there?
Well, you have to organise your own flights. As a volunteer with Shelterbox, to me personally, it's cost neutral. So they pay my fares and they pay my subsistence, but I'm just not paid at all when I'm there. So once I arrive there, I've got contacts in the country. We've been working with a charity foundation called the Barzani Charity Foundation in northern Iraq. They organise transport for us from the airport. They meet us from the airport and take us up to the nearest town, which was Dermiz. And I was part of a second team that had gone in. So the first team had gone and assessed the situation.
When you say team, how many?
There were only two in that. They have to go out, they have to see if it's going to be appropriate to send the kit out. Mm. Having decided that, they then call in the kit and then start distribution. So I was in the second wave, so that process had already been undergone. And it was a matter of us putting up lots and lots of tents with teams of local people. Mm. And when you're working in a refugee camp, then there are lots of people who can come and help you because there's an awful lot of unemployment, obviously.
So you are actually camping as well in the camp?
Very often. In this situation, we weren't. It was recommended that we didn't stay in the camp. Sometimes you do, but you know, those people are living, as I say, under terrible circumstances. And sometimes if they see Westerners coming in who maybe have got good equipment and things, it can make people behave in ways that they wouldn't normally behave. So one has to be really careful. So we always left the camp at sunset. We didn't stay at night.
I'm just sort of thinking of logistics. How many tents were you able to erect in the time that you were there and sort of see families? And well, who got the accommodation? How do you decide which families are most in need?
Well, the decision, we have certain criteria. Mm. So things like people who have special needs, single parent families, families with lots of children, those sorts of things. We have a sort of a criteria of need, and we tell the organisation that we're working with what our criteria is. We don't make the decision saying that A, B, C and D should have a tent because that can turn nasty. We leave it up to their internal organisation to decide that. So we then will start a distribution point and have lists of people. And so then we will either have put the tents up first, which is what happened in this situation. We put up 500 tents. And so then we distribute it. So all the families come to us and then we take them, show them how to use the tent, show them how to use the equipment. In fact, we tend to do that in groups so that you're not repeating it all the time.
You've been to Haiti as well, yes. Post-disaster.
Yes, after the earthquake there, the Shelterbox had a presence there for over a year. And so I was there about 4 or 5 months after the disaster, and we were working with other organisations, and my main role was actually going round and putting up tents for people who had been injured. I mean, there was one instance of a woman who had had her leg amputated and she was 5 months pregnant. Her children, her other children, had all been killed, and she was given a tent which was being put up just beside her mother's very small house, and she was there with her new baby and her only one leg. So there was another colleague and I, we were there, cleared the ground and put the tent up for her. But that was so satisfying because this woman, the bottom had fallen out of her world. Then to be able to give something positive like that was incredible.
Do you find it difficult as an aid worker going in, looking at the situation in which people are having to exist, because that's all they are doing, isn't it? Do you find that gets to you?
It's quite interesting, really, because I think that you have to have a certain amount of resilience, really. And if I internalised it all and sort of went back and wept at night, I probably wouldn't be any use. So one has to be resilient and do what you can. We're never going to be able to save the world.
No.
So my personal philosophy is one person at a time, or in this case, one family at a time.
And you've also had to cope with very difficult geographical conditions. I mean, some of these disasters never hit the headlines, actually. No. I remember you went off to Chile.
Yes.
And there had been massive floods and landslides. Mm-hmm. I don't think I saw it reported in the news at all.
Well, it was interesting because in Chile there was a big earthquake, which happened just after Haiti's earthquake. And I don't think anybody knew about it at all. And yet they'd had a big tsunami there as well. Whole areas were devastated and nobody got to know. The same in Colombia with mudslides, and in Peru. I was in Peru twice last year. where they'd had mudslides up in the Andes and they'd had flooding in the Amazon basin. So, you know, big disasters. And it somehow seems that over in the UK, we don't get to hear what happens in South America.
How do you cope with, you know, mudslides and trying to put up tents and give basic shelter in probably pouring rain? Well, that probably is not an adjective that torrential downpours will be better.
Well, it's interesting, really, because most of the disasters have started before we arrive. You know, we are on the ground really quickly after a disaster, but it may take us a few days to get there, by which time either the rains have stopped or the ground stopped shaking. And so we're in that sort of, it's the initial vanguard, but it's not immediate. So things like the mudslides happen really quickly. The rain happens, but actually the moving of the earth happens slowly. So people know that it's going to happen, so they have time to move away. And certainly last year up in the Andes, there were villages that had had the whole centre taken away, but houses were still standing on the edge. And so a lot of those people we relocated to a large playing field and put up tents for them there. So it is quite hard to see people who are bereft because they've lost their possessions, but it's worse when you see people who've lost their families. That's really hard. And I can't take that on board, really, because I can't imagine what it's like.
And getting there must be not only perilous geographically, but, I mean, you are open to, you know, people who might stop you on the road, presumably?
Yes, there's always a danger. I don't look for the danger, so I don't see it. It might be stupid, but there are so many other things to concentrate on. But most people are really pleased to see us. I sometimes think that, you know, up in Peru, for instance, up in the Andes, there comes a granny over the hill with a tent from a country that they hardly know, and they haven't seen somebody from their own country, and they're absolutely astounded. You know, why am I there? What am I doing this for? You know, how come their country isn't there? It is quite awe-inspiring, really. I mean, the whole concept of Shelter Box is incredible, really. And I've been with them now for nearly 5 years and still love it.
I'm not content with that. You also are a trustee of a much smaller charity working in a very remote village in Kenya called Buburi.
That's right. I got involved with that when I decided that I wanted to have a career change. After my husband died, I was only in my early 50s and I just thought, is this it? You know, am I just going to carry on my job and, you know, just carry on my life? And I did for a while, and then I thought, nope, I've got a bit more, I can do a bit more. And so I retrained and I did the Diploma in Tropical Nursing at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And I met another nurse from Exeter there, but I also met another woman, Joanna Hanks, from the Isle of Wight, and she had been involved with this place called Buburi in Western Kenya. And she had started a very small little clinic. And so I went out there for 2 months and it gets under your skin, really. And so I became involved with it. So I've been doing that since about 2007. And we're now a charity, a registered charity in the UK. And it's a primary healthcare centre. And we subsidise all the drugs and we pay all the salaries. The patient pays a very small amount. But the people there are incredibly poor. And it's a very rural area. There's virtually no infrastructure around there. And nobody wants to go and live there. It is the end of nowhere. And so we pay all the salaries. We've now just employed our 12th person. We've now started maternity services. And this year we will see somewhere in the region of 12,000 patients. Malaria is huge there. It's in what's called the Lake Endemic Area, and they get the worst type of malaria there. So we do a lot of training. We have volunteer community health workers who go out into the community. We've got a nurse, a midwife, a clinical officer. We've opened a very small laboratory there now. And every so often I think, oh my goodness, I can't believe we're doing this. And, you know, then I go back to my nice little middle-class life and my power shower when I'm at home. Out there, there is no running water or electricity where we stay. The clinic has just had electricity connected in May this year, and we just raised enough money to drill a borehole in the grounds. So they're hopefully starting work on that next week. And that will mean that the clinic has water, but it also means the surrounding community will have water. At the moment, they have to walk about a kilometre to a borehole, which maybe doesn't sound like a huge distance, but if you've then got to carry home, you know, a 20-litre jerry can or two or three or four of those, it's quite a lot, you know, when you think how much water we all get through a day. To have water close by will make a huge difference to the community.
I remember you writing, because you do a sort of blog when you're out there, didn't you? And I remember you writing about this mother who brought her son in who was really seriously ill, and to the point where you hadn't got the facilities to treat him. Do you remember that?
Oh, it was awful. It was a Saturday morning, and I remember I was in the dispensary and I could hear this very high-pitched cry, which is usually a sign that there's something neurological going on, something in the brain. And I went out there and there was this child who was having a fit, and he'd obviously got cerebral malaria, which is life-threatening. In this country, I mean, I know we people don't get malaria here, but if there was somebody that was that ill, you'd phone 999, wouldn't you, and get an ambulance. Well, nothing like that there. Somebody had to run up the road to the village and get somebody to come back on a motorbike. And we sat the father on the back of the motorbike and strapped the child to him with cloth so that the child's airway was maintained, and sent them off to the local hospital. And I saw the father a few days later, because he worked as a bicycle technician under a tree in the village up the road. And he came rushing up to tell us that the child was much, much better. And he said, "He looks just like you." And I said, "What do you mean he looks like me?" And he said, "Well, he's very nearly white," because he was so anemic, because he had had malaria so many times it had attacked his red blood cells. And so he was incredibly anemic. But actually, he lived and he was fine.
It's wonderful when you hear those sort of stories.
It makes such a difference.
The charity is making a difference as well.
But I'm really lucky, because A, I can afford to do this, and B, it's given me a new lease on life. I feel like I've reinvented myself. And you know, it just because I'm retired now doesn't mean that I'm going to sit at home crocheting. I don't know how to crochet anyway.
It's quite demanding, this sort of work. You need a lot of energy.
Yes, I'm very fortunate. I do have a lot of energy. And I say I'll carry on doing it all until my knees and hips go. But they haven't yet.
Well, I hope they don't for a long time, Sally. And thank you very much for coming to talk to us today. It's been really interesting.
Well, thank you very much.